Lost and Sound is sponsored by Audio Technica. Audio Technica are a global but still family-run company that make headphones, turntables, cartridges, microphones. They make studio-quality, yet affordable products because they believe that high-quality audio should be accessible to all. So wherever you are in the world, head on over to audiotechnica.com to check out all of their range of stuff. Hello and welcome to Lost and Sound. I'm Paul Hamford, I'm your host. I'm an author, a broadcaster and a lecturer based in Berlin, where I'm speaking to you now from. And this is the show where each episode I have conversations with the musical innovators, the outsiders, the mavericks, the artists that do their own unique thing. And we talk about music, creativity, life, the stuff that inspires us to make the things that we make. Previous guests have included Peaches, Suzanne Ciani, Jim O'Rourke, Chili Gonzalez, Cozy Funny Tutti, Jean-Michel Jarre, Miki Blanco, Anne First and more. And today on the show, I have a conversation with underground electronic producer Lou Kid. My book, Coming to Berlin, is available in all good bookshops or via the publisher's website, Velocity Press. And I'd just like to say a massive thank you to anyone that's read it so far and for the messages I get about that. It does mean a lot. So how are you doing? I'm coming at you from a very drizzly grey Berlin in the district of Neukölln, and today you're going to hear a chat I had yesterday, which was December the 12th, with producer Luke Blair. He's just released his first album under the name of Lou Kid for 11 years. It's called Tilt, and I think it's fucking great. He first started releasing music in the mid-90s under the name of Lou Kid, with a series of albums that have been described as like a younger, more gnarly, club-schooled relative of Steve Reich and Philip Glass's minimalism. And the last of these albums was way back in 2012. A lot's happened since then. He's been busy with other things, but now he's back with a new Lou Kid album. It's called Tilt, as I mentioned. That's no relation, as far as I know, to the Scott Walker album of the same name. I love this record. It's an electronic record that is pitched somewhere way far from the dance floor, but with still a kind of rhythmic connection to that. It's full of grain and atmosphere, and I'm a sucker for graininess in music anyway, where sounds are distorted, pitch bent, processed and processed again, echoed. It's something that I feel that this album or his work occupies a similar space in terms of listening to Boards of Canada or William Basinski. And often in that music, which plays with the notion of sort of degrading sounds, kind of echoing out sounds, is discussed in terms of like memory and what that means. And I don't know whether that's because the music can kind of sound faded in itself. But I would say Lou Kid's stuff is, it's got like a real rhythmic heart to it as well. He's also released music on Actress's label Verk in partnership with Ninja Tune, on Warp sublabel Arcola, and on Mute sublabel Liberation Technologies, as well as his own Glum imprint. And Glum is the label that he's released Tilt on. He's also one half of Reset, who've released music on the Trilogy tapes, I should say. So yes, we had this conversation. I hope you enjoy it. And yeah, this is what happened when I met Lou Kid. Well, thanks for chatting with me today. I've been listening to Tilt for a few months, and it's the first New Kid release in over a decade, I think, album-wise. And, you know, obviously you've been very busy with lots of other stuff, but what made this the right time to come back with a New Kid album?
It wasn't a plan to wait 11 years or whatever it is. I'd kind of been meaning to release an album, and I'd had tracks that I'd made that I really wanted to get out, but I would feel like I had an album ready, then I'd listen back to it and think, don't know if it quite does it justice. I was being a bit of a perfectionist, really. And then COVID happened, and I kind of thought, well, I've got all this time, I might as well try and get something out. It's also, I feel like COVID was a little bit of a wake-up call in terms of, I mean, maybe in hindsight it seems a bit silly, but at the time, you know, it was a pretty dramatic thing. And it was like, oh, you know, who knows what's going to happen in life. It's no good having this music just sitting there on my hard drive if no one can hear it. I mean, not that the world needs to hear it, but, you know, I kind of didn't feel like that, you know, the music of mine that's on, that is out there on Spotify and stuff is pretty old, or before this. I kind of felt it didn't really represent me. So, you know, I started thinking, you know, if I'd meet someone at a party or something, and they would say, what do you do? And I would explain I made music, and they'd be like, oh, what name do you use? So I'd tell them. And then I'd think, oh, they're going to go home now and put that into Spotify, YouTube, whatever plays first. That's what they're going to judge me on.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like also, so did you record the bulk of it, like sort of from COVID onwards?
Maybe like half and half. The first track on the album that's from like 8 years ago. That was one, I've always liked that track, and everyone I've sent that to, you know, people I kind of trust, they've always been like, oh yeah, that's, you should put that out. So I kind of wanted to release that for a long time. And then from that, I started putting stuff together during COVID, and it was maybe little ideas that I'd made over the years and then some new stuff. So a mixture, I would say.
Yeah. And did like that kind of sort of, you sort of saying like COVID was like this kind of point as well, you know, because the music you do is, Luke, it is really, really atmospheric. And was there sort of a connection sort of between this kind of weird time and space and kind of maybe like the space that you're living in and the way we're all grounded in terms of like how the sounds came about and your processes on it?
I'm always inclined to maybe say that I'm not that affected by my surroundings in that way, but I mean, it must have an effect. I'm always in a little bit of a bubble, I guess, in my studio. I'm working alone. So, I mean, it'd be hard for me to say, like, concretely that I was affected by the pandemic in terms of the sounds that I made, but it was maybe in terms of my outlook and my work ethic focused me a bit. I was living in Lisbon at the time. I was in Portugal. And the way, you know, like separated from my family. So there was that extra kind of element of isolation, which was quite a weird thing. But then it was, maybe I shouldn't say this, but it was quite a nice place to be for the pandemic. Like,
yeah, I could imagine. Yeah.
Nice weather. You know, Lisbon's a beautiful city, and it was kind of quite empty, unusually. So it was kind of amazing to walk around it, and it was inspiring, but it's hard to say how exactly personally.
Yeah. And so what were you doing in Lisbon? Were you moved out there at a time, or was it one of those things where we all kind of got stuck somewhere?
I was living there. I'd been out there about a year and a half. I met my girlfriend there, so I moved over. And also Jackson, who's the other half of Resit, who's another project of mine, he was living out there. So it all kind of came together. So I was there for a couple of years, and then COVID happened. So I was there for another year or two after that.
Yeah. And you're back in the UK now.
Yeah, back in London, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And like, I mean, I think also sort of thing, one of the things I get most about listening to it is that, and I guess with a lot of your other stuff as well, is it's like a lot of the sounds aren't that easy to place. And is that kind of an important thing for you, you know, to kind of make sounds kind of a little bit unidentifiable to their source?
Yeah, it is. I always kind of plan to make an album or to make music where that isn't the idea, where it's taking things back to basics. But then I can never quite resist, like, keep like just processing things to the point where they become a little bit unrecognizable. It's, I don't know. Often I'll like make a track and I'll have it there, but I'll listen back to it and just think that it's a bit too normal. And then I'll like kind of use that track, sample it again and make another track out of that, and just like, you know, just keeping on the layers going until it sounds individual enough, I guess, is what it's what the aim is, whether I achieve it or not, I don't know.
Well, I mean, it sounds it to me. But like, do you sort of know instinctively when enough is enough is on a track? You know, like if you're kind of processing sounds, is there like a sweet spot? And if there is there like a sort of way you can kind of like describe the feeling you get when you get that sweet spot?
I find that the only way to know if I have that sweet spot is to make something, leave it for a while and then come back to it. So I try to make quite a lot of sketches and ideas, just have them there in a folder, and then I'll come back to them with fresh ears. And yeah, usually, you know, I'll put something on and be immediately like, okay, yeah, this is something. Like that, I wouldn't be able to say what that feeling is, but it's just like, okay, yeah, this, I feel like I could listen to this for a while, that kind of thing. Like this could be a track.
Yeah. It starts to kind of get a bit of a life of its own.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The individual elements kind of come together to make something rather than it sounding. I think you're right. Like sometimes with my own stuff, I kind of don't like to be able to hear how it was made necessarily, which is strange because with other music, I actually quite like that. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when I made music, it was kind of the same, actually. I mean, I kind of related it to being a bit like in films where you kind of have like the filters on and, you know, like the grading sort of gives it a sort of, I can't stand watching films on that kind of high definition TV where, you know,
motion.
Yeah. It's disgusting.
Motion smoothing. It's the worst.
Yeah. It is. It just makes like something just look really like an episode of The Bill from the 80s or something.
Yeah, like El Dorado.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to turn it off for my parents every time I go around. I don't know how it turns itself back on, but...
Yeah, I think they secretly like it. My dad does that as well. Yeah. And again, a lot of these sort of techniques that you use, or that I kind of get come across, is like there's a lot of like sound degradation, some kind of like pitch bending, and things feel very kind of like earthy and grainy. And, you know, previously, like I've read interviews where you said you used a lot of tape to get this. Did you use a lot of tape on this album?
A little bit. Not loads. I had a tape player out in Lisbon and it broke down maybe like a year into my stay there. So maybe a few tracks had it on it. And other stuff, like I said, it's just kind of working with stuff until it gets this certain sound. Not always with tape, but yeah. And it's weird because often I will, even if I make an effort to make something sound a bit different to normal, it ends up sounding like me, I guess, which can be a bit annoying, but I guess it's a good thing. I don't know. So yeah, a little bit of tape on this, but not loads. I sometimes feel like that can be a little bit of a shortcut. You can get kind of addicted to that sound and feel like nothing's completed until I've added that layer. So I tried to move away from that a bit, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the kind of thing about kind of like being a producer and an artist, is like each project, it's like you have your things, but you also sort of like look to sort of see how you can maneuver them in different directions, I guess.
Yeah, it is. I've never quite worked like that in terms of having a new kind of setup for each project, which I think maybe I possibly should do going forward. I'm a little bit stuck in my ways. Like I've always kind of just worked in my computer hard with software, not much of a hardware man.
But I guess that makes it quite remote as well. Like it kind of gives you the opportunity to, like, if you're in Lisbon, kind of start recording there and not think about lugging.
It does. Although when I moved to Lisbon, I lugged over my massive old PC because I was so stuck in my ways that I was using an old version of Cubase and felt like I couldn't really use anything else. So it was insane that I did that. Anyway, I have learned to use Ableton properly in the last couple of years. So yeah, now I am fully remote.
Yeah. Oh, bless Cubase. I think it's sort of disappearing away a bit from people's consciousness.
I know. But I stuck with it. I gave it my best. But yeah, it was time.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know if this is just something I kind of draw on myself when I listen. And so I apologize, it is. But I feel like so quite often, like, there's this kind of connection between sort of like kind of tape degradation or degrading sounds and like memory. And I know that I was reading the other day that music responds to the same part of our brains that memory does as well, and nostalgia. And is that something like you kind of draw on yourself, or is that just like, you know, that's for whatever the listener kind of like picks out on?
I mean, I think I do. And I have heard that word nostalgia used when people are talking about my music. And it's maybe something I tried to avoid, because I do think it can be a little bit easy to, you know, there are these kind of signifiers that can be overused in music where it is giving it that nostalgic sound, which is not something I particularly want to do. But I mean, triggering that kind of emotion, yeah, definitely. That's triggering that kind of response is, I think, that's something I aim for. It's hard to put your finger on, isn't it, that feeling? But it's maybe it sounds a bit like something you kind of already know, but is not.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, you know, we'll think of like music that we've heard, like maybe sort of at the formative point in our life that we feel that we've heard somewhere else and we haven't.
Yeah. That, I mean, like you were asking before about how I know when I have found an idea that can go somewhere. I think it is when it sounds like it could be something that already existed, kind of, in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. It's a sort of trigger in a good way, I guess. Yeah. Obviously, as Lukid as well, you know, obviously, you know, you collaborate with people, there's scores as well. But like, as Lukid, like they kind of started around the mid-noughties, right? And I mean, looking back now, what do you think has changed the most for you since then in terms of like your kind of creativity and the way you work?
I feel like I have a bit more of a vision of what I want to achieve these days. You know, I was quite young when I started releasing music, and feel a bit like I kind of stumbled into it without necessarily knowing what I wanted to achieve. I was just, you know, I loved making music, and I did it for the fun of it. And now it's kind of, I don't know. I had that big gap, like you were saying, of over a decade. I kind of started thinking, do I need to release this music? Does it have a purpose? So I don't know. Yeah, I feel like I have more clarity these days and what I want to achieve. My process is not that dissimilar, to be honest. Still just me kind of plugging away on a computer, I guess. So not that much has changed.
Yeah. I mean, what about the industry in itself? Because, you know, when you started releasing, you know, it was that sort of era of like digital was still relatively a new thing, and a lot of like smaller labels were kind of adapting to it or maybe not adapting to it. And now it seems like, you know, we've gone in from digital to like more streaming, and then like sort of the more hyper capitalist sort of end of sort of tech company streaming as well, you know. And I'm sort of wondering how that sort of plays out for you, or what you reckon about that.
I mean, I don't know. I have mixed feelings. When I started releasing music, it felt like stuff got more attention because I guess there was less release. Like in hindsight, I was pretty lucky to have a reasonable amount of like, you know, reviews and press about the music I was releasing back then. These days, it doesn't really quite exist. But at the same time, I didn't really see it as a viable way to make money back then, releasing music. Because, well, you would release a record and then that was kind of it. There wasn't really, you know, there wasn't streaming. There was digital sales, but no one really bought much of that. So these days, I guess it's kind of nice that you can be, you can have a catalog out there that's generating revenue.
Simple
way to look at it, I guess. But it feels a bit more like you're at, like if I release music these days, it feels a bit more like I'm adding to my kind of catalog that people can listen to whenever they want.
Your body of like work. Streaming and stuff like that, you can kind of like look and see, you know, all your albums lined up and
yeah. But I guess the flip side of that is there's so much music these days being released that it's kind of hard to know if anyone's listening, or feels like a bit of a flooded market. I don't know if I have particularly strong feelings about that.
Yeah. I mean, I know that it's like, I mean, I have to kind of watch my kind of like grumpy old man.
Yeah.
Things that just sort of kick in, you know, at age. And in some ways, I do miss the element of discovery.
Yeah.
Is that something that you miss as well? Or?
Yeah. I do miss that. Like, I don't really go to record shops that much these days, which is on me. It's not society's fault. But yeah, I used to find a lot just by stumbling on them in record shops. And these days, you're kind of at the mercy of the algorithm. Which can also be quite good, but but then also I've always used the internet to discover stuff, so that hasn't changed too much. There are less blogs these days. Blogs used to be much better
for finding stuff. Definitely, yeah.
And I still use YouTube a lot. I don't know. Once again, I don't know if my process has changed that much in terms of finding music. In that, I still, apart from going to shops, I do still kind of just trawl.
Yeah,
YouTube and. The corners of the internet to try and find stuff. So I still do that. But
yeah. I mean, it is there. It's just you have to kind of, there's the algorithm kind of comes in and sort of, you have to go beyond. I guess it's the same with like, you know, music production as well. Like, you know, you have to, it's that kind of thing of going, you can turn off the grid and stuff. If you want to, you know, it's there and it's helpful, but it doesn't have to be there.
You got to dig a bit deeper. Yeah.
I mean, and also like, I mean, how did you get into the film scoring as well?
I do scoring in general. Maybe it's a, I don't want to say that I've only done some short films and one longer documentary. So I don't know if I should characterize myself as a film scorer, but scoring in general, I don't know. It's just, it's been a slow process of kind of building up relationships with different directors and people who work in different fields and being willing to kind of do work on these things over the years, and I'm getting more and more work. I guess it's a weird field because it's not really a direct route into it. If you want to do film scoring, then yeah, you can study that, which I didn't. So I don't know. There's a few people who I've kind of worked with over the years on different projects, on little documentaries, on more advertising-y stuff. Yeah, I think just building up those relationships is kind of how I've had to do it. Over the years, I've tried to work out if there's a better way of doing it, if there are like agencies or who can help out with this stuff. But it's just, everyone I've talked to has kind of said you just kind of have to just be willing to work hard when the opportunity does come up and then try and get more work that way. And yeah.
I mean, that's as far as I've heard as well. And what would you say like the main differences as well between kind of taking on a project where you're scoring something visual to kind of working on your own material or collaborating with someone just for music?
I mean, it depends on the project a lot. Some of the advertising stuff I've done, you just have to be willing to do what they want, basically, which will sound nothing like anything I produced under Lucid, or is it?
Mm.
So you kind of have to be willing to take the cues and work to a brief and get a lot of feedback and not take it personally. And all those things can be quite refreshing after working on your own for a few months. It's quite nice to have some direction.
Mm.
With the more kind of experimental stuff I've done, it's, I guess, having the video there as a starting point is the big difference. You have a visual cue to work from, which I really like. I really like doing that. So yeah, I guess, yeah, that's the difference, is you have these outside, what's the word? Inputs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not just sitting there scratching your head wondering where to start. You know.
Yeah. And I imagine that could be quite good. So, I mean, it must be like sort of in a way, like more of like a, you know, being able to kind of have like a map out an exercise, really, rather than kind of just going off into sort of like uncharted territory.
Yeah, it's great. I love the challenge of it. It's, you know, it's fun. And when balanced with doing my own stuff, I think, it works well, I think.
Mm.
If I was doing just one of the two all the time, I might start going a bit mad, but I think the balance is good for me.
Yeah. I think there's the times when I've just been left or had the opportunity or the privilege to kind of get on with my own projects, it always feels like it's going to be an amazing thing to do. And I always do really enjoy it, but I forget about the fact that I suddenly stop bouncing off other people and how much like input can kind of really just move things along. And
absolutely. Amazing how much a deadline can spark you into action, you know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And you're right, it does seem so appealing. If I am deep in some work like that, I start fantasizing about having all this time on my own where I can just do my own projects. Like you're saying, that comes around and then you're sitting in a room staring at a wall.
Yeah, okay. This isn't what I was imagining it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, and how did music kind of come into your life in the first place? Did you have like a musical family or?
Not, I guess like the normal amount of music in the family. I got two older brothers, so I guess there was always that influence. Like they're quite a fair bit older, like 5 and 8 years older.
Hmm.
So I had that head start. I think that's always a bit of a head start when... they're bringing good music into the house when I was, you know, 8 or whatever. So I can remember like a lot of, like, I don't know, Public Enemy and De La Soul, like lots of early 90s hip hop.
Mm.
That's my earliest kind of memories of music in the house. And also, you know, like just the Beatles and stuff like that on the family cassette player. And my eldest brother was really into the guitar. Like he was a really good guitar player and he was really into Hendrix. So I started playing the guitar when I went to secondary school, started doing lessons. So I guess maybe that was the first step into actually, you know, taking my interest to a slightly different level.
Mm. And did you go through like a being in bands phase with the guitar? No.
No, I never did that, which is possibly why I got into the computer music thing because I love playing guitar. I loved kind of working out how to play these songs that I loved. But no, I never got and I never got into a band. Mm. So I guess I was looking for some kind of outlet for this thing that I love doing. And they had the Cubase actually, I think at on the school computer in the music room.
Mm. So what kind of era was this?
I guess mid-90s.
Mm.
I was at secondary school from like 95 to 2000, so yeah.
Yeah.
And I took to that really immediately.
And were there any artists that, you know, at the time or like producers that you were kind of drawing on in terms of... hearing and then going and working on Cubase with?
I was trying to think of this earlier. It was more like I was just really into the the fun of making music. I mean, obviously I loved music at the time, but it was more like, it must have been when I first started doing that, I was more into like, I don't know, like Radiohead and guitar music and hip hop, maybe Wu-Tang and stuff. But it wasn't like, I wasn't at home listening to whatever, like drum and bass and thinking, oh, I need to go in and make some of this. It was more just the fun of making it. And the tracks that I'd make were, I wouldn't even know how to describe them, but I would kind of just build up these kind of epic, probably sound awful, like general MIDI tracks of just these different elements. And I just loved the way you could build up a whole song. Just all these, out of these elements that you made yourself. And like, you know, I would go into this lesson with nothing and come out of it with this track that I could sing in my head.
I mean, I love that as well, because I think I started in guitar bands, but then when I kind of started playing with electronic sounds, just again, I what you were saying, I really reflected on myself, and that I love that feeling of, yeah, just starting off with nothing. Yeah. And then regardless of whether it was good or not, and to be honest, when I started, it probably wasn't very good at all, but just being able to build up like a whole world of sound just out of nothing.
Yeah, I found it kind of addictive.
Mm.
And then, you know, through that, then I think I started getting into electronic music kind of from doing it myself, I guess. And my oldest brother, he, you know, I think he noticed I was into it. So he started kind of giving me stuff. And so then I started listening to kind of Aphex and more that kind of thing. Got really into the first Boards of Canada album, obviously. And then, yeah, I don't know, my taste develops definitely as I grew into my teens. But at the start, it was just messing around, really.
Yeah. And what kind of led up to On and On came out in 2007. And I apologize if I'm wrong about this, but was that the first Lou Kid release, or had you done like a few singles before then? Or
that was the first.
And what kind of led up to that? Like, where were you living at the time? What was the sort of vibe?
I was living in London. I had studied music production in Leeds for 2 years, although I didn't actually complete the course, I don't think. And I was back in London. I was working as just like a runner for this like media company.
Grabbing the coffees in Soho.
Yeah, exactly. In Hoxton, actually, even worse.
Yeah.
I'd been making stuff all this time. And I'd actually, there was a, you know, there's a few people I would send stuff to. One was my oldest brother, Sam. Another one was a friend of his who became a friend of mine called Davin, who actually got me that job as a runner. And I would give him mini discs, and he was always very encouraging of my music. And then he eventually was like, oh, well, you should send it to this label called Work Discs, which I didn't know about. And then I looked them up, and I really loved the music they released, so I sent a CD to them. And I got an email back, and then that became, oh, what was on that CD. But yeah, anyway, the album was not, I guess, not too long after that.
And were you kind of what was your relationship with electronic? Were you sort of clubbing a bit at the time, or?
A little bit. I was a bit, you know, I regret this a bit, because it was a great time to be in London. But I was more inclined to kind of stay at home and listen to stuff on my own. I mean, I was going to Plastic People a bit. Yeah, like my brother, he kind of took me under his wing a little bit and took me out to places. In Leeds, I'd been going out a bit. Used to go to Subdub. I don't know if you know that night a lot.
I don't know that. I definitely remember Plastic People, sadly missed, but I don't know that.
Yeah, so Plastic People, I used to go to the, Theo Parrish used to play there every month on a Sunday. So I'd go to that. And there was a night called CDR where you could take along your own music and they would play it. But no, I wasn't going out that much, to be honest. It was more, once again, it was like I was enjoying making it and was really kind of stuck into that. And I was, you know, I was listening to a lot of music at home. But it was never really through any particular scenes that I got into it.
Yeah, it's interesting actually, isn't it? Because some artists really do connect their work with like a scene,
yeah.
And a lot of artists don't as well. And I can't, you obviously seem like an artist that sort of feels very independent from like being pigeonholed or being put into a scene or feeling like, you know, like come from the drum and bass scene, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think either of those ways are any better. I mean, I do actually kind of regret in some ways not being more connected to a scene or not making music that was particularly of a genre. But I guess the way it worked for me and my personality was that it was more just, I don't know, doing my own thing.
And I guess that's the kind of good thing about kind of creativity anyway, isn't it? Is like you find the way that suits you rather than, you know, there being one route or anything.
Definitely. But I think working within a genre is, I don't know, sometimes it's good to have outside influences and have people kind of pushing you on. And sometimes it can feel a bit like just working in the dark otherwise. And in the last few years I've started making kind of jungle stuff, which has been quite liberating, I would say, because it is quite fun working within the rules of a genre, you know. Sometimes limitations can be very helpful.
Goes back into what we were saying earlier on about like working in film and working kind of on your own stuff as well, having the limitations and the direction.
Yeah, there are these rules that you kind of had to stick by. And it's like, oh wow, I can kind of just follow these rules and I'll have a track. It's great.
And I think that can be quite, because when I was making music as well, I definitely didn't did my own thing or work with people doing our own thing. And then I kind of later kind of in other mediums kind of work more to rules. And it's suddenly like, it's like, oh wow, you know, if I put that there and that there, I can fill it out in my own creative way. But it's like, wow, I didn't realize that there was a way to do stuff.
Yeah. I didn't realize I didn't have to torture myself.
Yeah.
didn't have to reinvent the wheel all along.
Yeah. Do you feel like if you do another Lucid album as well, that there's like a sort of a level that you have to sort of set yourself to, like, you know, you sort of mentioned about torturing yourself. Do you feel like it's something that in order to do it you have to feel ready in a certain way? Or
I mean, I think that was the case with this last album, but I feel like maybe I'm gonna have to try and be a bit easier on myself going forward. I'm kind of more up for just releasing stuff now, I think. I mean, I say that, who knows what happened, but yeah, I think I don't need to be so precious about it, I think, going forward.
That's really nice.
And you know, I think it's nice for people to get these little snapshots of your output, you know? Yeah, like I was saying about kind of adding to my body of work, I think that's kind of maybe the way I'm going to look at it a bit, or I can just add to it every now and again, you know?
Yeah. And I guess that's like, one of the benefits of streaming now is that you can just, rather than just have releases, you can kind of, yeah, like you say, just add to it from time to time.
But I guess in response to that question, I do have these different projects, so yeah, there are things that I make them feel like a Lucid thing, I guess. And I'll add them to that playlist, and then there's other stuff that I make and I think, oh, that could be a refreshers track, or oh, that could be Resit, or that could be something else.
Yeah, that was it, Luke, thanks so much. Yeah.
Pleasure.
Okay, so that was me, Paul Hanford, talking with Luke Blair, aka Lucid, and we had that conversation on the 12th of December 2023. Thanks so much, Luke, for sharing your thoughts and your time with me for that. The album Tilt is out now on Glum. It's really good. Check it out if you've not had a listen to it. Yes, Lost and Sound is proudly sponsored by Audio Technica, a global but still family-run company that make headphones, turntables, cartridges, microphones, studio quality, yet affordable products, because they believe that high-quality audio should be accessible to all. And I use their AT2020 USB mic to do all my interviews. It's so easy. You just plug it straight in. You get studio quality sound. Fucking love it. My book, Coming to Berlin, is available in all good bookshops or via the publisher Velocity Press's website. And the music you hear at the beginning, at the end of every episode of Lost and Sound is by Thomas Giddens. Hyperlink in the show description. Right, so that's me for today. That might be me for the year, actually. I might try and put one more episode out before the end of the year. I know that sounds a bit vague, but you know what it's like when it gets to December and it's that combination of just trying to get everything done and also sort of like you feel yourself just winding down slower and slower each day, even if the volume around you goes up more and more. But there might be one, or that might be it for this year. But either way, thanks so much for listening. I mega appreciate it. I hope you're having a great day, and yeah, chat to you soon.